Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras, the number one podcast for bow hunting product information and hunting stories from across the nation. And now, here's your nine-fingered host, Dan Johnson.
Bop, bop, bop. Boom, boom, boom. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. Thank you very much for tuning in. And today we have, it's been a while since I've had one of these podcasts where we have a kind of a company spotlight podcast, you know, hunting gear related. And today we're going to have a really cool, fun podcast with Jason Phelps of Phelps Game Calls. He cut his teeth on elk calls, but also does turkey, also does predator, and what else? Waterfowl and deer calls too. So, you know, Phelps Game Calls runs the gamut, so to speak. But today's podcast is really cool. We talk about how his season went, how Phelps Game Calls got started, where it's at now, and where he plans on going with the company. So just a really cool podcast. Other than that, man, my weekend was a blast. Went on a little family outing. My dad took me and my family and my brother and his family to Des Moines, Iowa. We went to a whole bunch of museums. We went to a farmer's market. We went swimming in the pool, which was, if you ask my daughter, is probably her favorite thing. We went to a zoo, went to the science center. It was just really cool, interesting, and I don't know about you guys, I'm a nerd when it comes to science, so we went into an IMAX type of theater and watched this, I guess, IMAX movie about engineering, and I don't know, I loved it. I got to go to the zoo and saw some monkeys do some really cool things. Snakes, fish, birds. My daughter ate all that up. My son ate all of it up. And just had an overall awesome family weekend. And next weekend, we were going to go on another little family outing because it's Memorial Day. But the river's too high. And the fishing isn't good, so says my father-in-law. So I think what's going to happen is I'm going to probably do some, I don't know, I think I might try to do some whitetail stuff, like some tree stands, some more mineral, some trail cameras, get all that out, get that set so I can start enjoying the velvet rut. All those things need to be done before the season starts, and hopefully my goal is to get that done before, the second weekend in June. That's my goal, to have it all done by then. Now, that's a pretty lofty goal considering, you know, I have two kids who are maniacs. Other than that, let's see here. Today, Ozonics, right? They're a partner of the podcast. You guys know I'm a believer in their product. I have been since the day I got to play around with it. I was skeptic at first, just probably like a lot of you guys. Used the product, saw good results with it, you know, used it more, saw great results from it, and now it's one of those products that is in the tree with me all the time. But today, I want to let all of you know of a discount code that they extended to specifically the Nine Finger Chronicles listeners, and that is 9Fingers17. That's 9, the number 9, Fingers17. And I think that's going to get you $50 off of orders over 700 or over 700. That's $50 off over orders of $400, $399. So roughly, if you buy the $400 unit, you're going to get 12.5% off the HR200, which is still a great deal. You're not going to find that anywhere else, whether that's in a box store or online anywhere. So that's an awesome opportunity. Take advantage of it. Save $50 on the HR200. That's a great introductory product for Ozonics. And if you're looking to save a little bit of money, there you go. Other than that, I think we're good to go. If you want to find out more information on Ozonics, go to ozonixhunting.com and find out more information. And then if you do purchase, like I said, 9Fingers17, and that's your discount code. So other than that, I say we get into this podcast with Jason Phelps of Phelps Game Calls. All right, on the phone with me now is Mr. Jason Phelps. How you doing today, Jason?
Good.
All right, so you are the owner of Phelps Game Calls, right?
Correct.
All right, and how I start all these out is we're going to get into all that later, right? But the reason that we do all the stuff that we're going to talk about later is to get out there and hunt, and you know, because we love nature and all that stuff. So how did your 2016 hunting season go?
It was good. It was a great season. Kind of give you the overview first. I was fortunate enough to call in 4 bulls that either I was able to kill 2 of the bulls, and then call in 2 for buddies, and then had an awesome deer hunt in Colorado. So overall, it was a good hunt. The freezer was full, which is the most important. But other than that, you know, a ton of great memories, a ton of great time in the mountains.
So you calling for, see, you, out of the 4 bulls that you called in, you killed 2 of them. I take it.
Yep.
2 of your buddies, you called in for 2 of your buddies.
Correct.
So do they pressure you into coming with them because you own a game call company and you're probably, if I had to guess, the best at calling, or is it something you volunteer to do?
No, I'm actually very fortunate and blessed that my hunting buddies are very, very good callers, and we're all on the same page. So even if I can't see them, hear them, talk to them during a setup, we're usually, you know, really dang close on what I want them to say or to help me. I don't know if it's stubbornness or bullheadedness, but I typically call for them, but then I turn around and call for myself. And maybe I'm selfish because, like I said, they're extremely capable callers. I just always end up kind of taking the lead, even on my own hunts.
Well, it sounds to me like you live by the "if you want something done right, do it yourself" mentality.
Yeah, in a way, like I said, my hunt partners are very accomplished callers, very, very good. It just always ends up that way.
So how did that that deer hunt in Colorado go? Were you successful?
Yeah, we were able to fill 2 out of the 3 tags. You know, it was completely blind, really had nothing to go on besides us sitting here for, you know, a couple months leading up to the hunt, trying to figure out where we think the deer are going to be that time of year. Usually I can get to a unit, figure it out fairly quick. You know, it only takes you a couple days to run up and down from the bottom to the top, up creek, down the valley, and figure it out. This hunt took us a little longer, about 2 or 3 days to finally wrap our head around it. And then, kind of went into kill mode towards the end, but we were able to kill 2 out of 3, and two bucks got we catch and release, I should say. So we all should have filled our tags. We just brought 2 home. It was a good hunt. Had a chance at some really, really good bucks and took home some respectable bucks.
Nice. So was this, do you favor guns or archery?
I'm a diehard archery elk hunter. I have archery hunted deer in the past, here and there, but there's just something still that, I don't know, I love picking up a gun and hunting deer in late season, but there's nothing that beats, you know, that early archery elk hunt. So I'm a opportunist, you know, whatever season's available. And then one of my bulls I killed this year in New Mexico was a muzzleloader hunt. So I just, you know, there's only so much time in so many states to hunt. And so in order to spread that out, I'll pick up any weapon, you know, anytime throughout the fall to try to be out there.
Right. I had a buddy who lives out west, and he said, if there's a tag for it, I'll hunt it. So he just likes to go out and hunt, and whether that's with a rifle, muzzleloader, or bow, he likes to, you know,
yep,
he'll use whatever.
So, yeah, that's exactly how I am.
Where do you live? Where do you set up shop?
We are in Southwest Washington. Nobody will know where the city's at. We're about an hour south of Olympia, I guess would be probably the best way to put it. A real small city. I think the city of PL has like 600 residents. It's basically built around a logging camp here. We're one of the top, I think, top producers in the world for fir and hemlock production here. You know, so a lot of loggers in town kind of, you drive up and down our highway and it's 50% log trucks.
Gotcha.
So yeah, we live out here in Southwest Washington and, born and raised out here.
Is that on the peninsula, by the Olympic Mountains or Olympian Mountains?
We're south. We're about 2 hours south of the Olympic okay. Mountains. So we're, truly down in that southwest corner where that's kind of that northwestern peninsula.
Right.
Along the coast. But yeah, we are only about 45 minutes from the coast as well.
I tell you, I went on I had to go to Whibley Island for a wedding, you know, just northwest of Seattle.
Yep.
And took some ferries over to the Olympia Mountains, or is it Olympic Mountains?
Olympic.
Okay, the Olympic Mountains. And that's some gorgeous country out there.
Yeah, it's awesome. The Olympic Mountains are a little frustrating for me because some of the biggest elk I've ever seen are inside the Olympic Mountains, but it's a national park, so it's completely off limits.
It's always like that, though, man.
Yeah, it's cool, though. I mean, I believe there should be some spots like that, but it is frustrating to look in there, like, hiking through there. There's some great elk country in there that's completely forbidden.
Now, is that a Roosevelt elk that live in those?
Yeah, those are true Roosevelt elk. And just from what I know, paying attention up and down the coast, it's probably your best genetics in the world for true Roosevelts. You know, the Canadian, British Columbia, some of Vancouver Island has some giant true Roosevelts. But that area there has some really big bulls.
And that's big bulls as far as body size or antler size?
Well, both. So Roosevelt, okay. even the Roosevelts in my backyard, which tend to have, fairly small, horns, antler configurations, they still have big bodies. Those ones up there have giant bodies and giant, sets of headgear.
I gotcha. So what's the difference between an elk? Cause I heard, down in New Mexico where you also went, elk. That's a trophy state, right? So they consider it a trophy state. So big antlers there as well. Are the body size similar?
They're smaller. Once you get into really mature bulls, mature Rocky Mountain bulls, it kind of all starts to even out. But a truly large, mature Roosevelt's always going to be your biggest bodied bull. If you kill a really old 7, 8, 9-year-old bull in New Mexico, it's still going to have a large body, but they don't quite, oranges to oranges, the same age class, the Roosevelts are always going to be bigger and sometimes by quite a bit.
Gotcha. So is that out of all the places, I take it you've been to more than Washington and New Mexico to hunt elk. What other states have you been into to chase those guys?
So I really haven't expanded a lot. I grew up doing, until the internet arose, and I started paying attention. I never hunted outside of Washington probably for the first 20 years I hunted elk. And then I've hunted Montana, Idaho, and New Mexico since. So I've only got four states under my belt, but I've got points in every western state just kind of waiting for all the stars to align.
Right. And that's something that I'm doing as well as I'm putting in. See, my goal is to get out. I'll be cutting it real close. I got a baby due in mid to late September. So I'm going to be trying to get out to Colorado for an elk hunt. It'd be the first or the second week of September. And then meanwhile, for the last couple of years or last 4 years, I've been putting in points for Wyoming. So,
nice.
I don't know. There's something about me wanting to expand from whitetails to get out and start hunting other animals. I think about it a lot. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't imagine going without, at least one elk hunting. I try to get two in every year. One of these days I need to go chase whitetail around, but it's one of those things like, I don't know how you guys think, but it's tough, because we're kind of oversaturated with whitetail this, whitetail that, even on hunting TV. And it's like, man, growing up in the mountains, like maybe one day that spark will light. But like right now, it's like it's all mule deer and elk for me right now. But I think a whitetail hunt's definitely in my future as well.
Oh, yeah. And there's not that I like. I mean, I'm born and raised in Iowa, right? So I'm in the Mecca for whitetails, but it's just something different. and it's not, I don't know. I went out to Idaho. Most of that hunt was rain, and yep. I was in a tent a lot, but I ended up getting up there. I saw some elk. I heard some bugles, nothing really close, but it was different. And I was mobile and moving and calling a lot. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's just, it's something different. You're active, and I don't know. And plus it's the mountains, right? You can't beat those.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. I kind of always joke. I had a tree stand for about 15 minutes one time throughout my life. And I climbed up in, it was a self climber, and I had a couple, you know, straight fir trees behind my house. And I, you know, climbed up the tree and I sat there for about 10 minutes and I'm like, I can't do this, and climb back down. I don't, it's going to be tough. There's going to have to be, I'm going to have to be covered up in deer, or I'm going to go crazy.
Or I tell you what, you'll probably have to start in one of those states like North or South Dakota, where you do a spot and stalk hunt. That way you can still spot and stalk for whitetails, and then slowly transition into like something where there's river bottoms, and you can, you know, maybe a day of spot and stalk, and then a day or an hour or an evening of sitting in a tree, or, you know, something like that to ease you in, so you're not just sitting 8 hours in a tree stand your very first whitetail hunt.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't even do it.
Yeah. I've hunted mule deer in a blind here in Washington. We can use bait. And so it's not my typical, you know, my typical hunt. I went on the hunt and, we had deer in front of us all the time. So it was a lot better to, you know, to keep my attention on something, but it was still a struggle.
Right. Right. So how old were you when you started hunting elk?
Elk. So my dad and uncles, my dad has four other brothers. So there are five brothers. And then my grandpa and his brothers and uncles. So it was, elk hunting was always a rite of passage. Like, they let us hunt deer as soon as we could get our tags and pass our safety course. But elk hunting was reserved for like high school age. And so growing up, you know, I was allowed to deer hunt, and I don't remember fourth grade or third grade when I got my, my license, but they always kind of held this elk hunting over our head. Like, we weren't old enough. We weren't ready to do it. And so, we always kind of looked at it as that rite of passage. And so I started my freshman year, elk hunting. So that would have been like 13 or 14 years old.
Nice. When did you start becoming successful? I mean, cause I take it, there's a learning curve. You don't just go out and shoot an elk your very first year out, or,
well,
unless we're one of those guys who does, and then I hate you.
I'm going to be the hater. I've was able to find success fairly quickly and often.
Awesome.
You know, for a couple of reasons, my family, even in this area, is well known. They're pretty diehard elk hunters, and that was one of the reasons we couldn't go. We live on a tree farm, basically, you know, Weyerhaeuser's in our backyard. They log it every 40 years. It's not like elk hunting in the mountains, even, where these guys will jump off in the brush. They're all loggers. All my uncles and dads grew up loggers. They'll jump off in the brush and they'll just figure out how to hit a road 4 miles down the drainage, and somebody will pick them up, you know? And so I can understand now, you know, why 8 or 9 years old, they didn't want us doing that. But you know, so they were diehard elk hunters. They taught us well. They all worked in the woods. That was another advantage. You know, the young kids first year out, they knew where elk were. They had them patterned. They had us on the right landing in the right area on opening days. And then they usually let, you know, us younger kids do the majority of the shooting for the first couple of days until they had to jump into the brush and chase them. Right. So rifle hunting / muzzleloader hunting, like I said, always kind of been an opportunist. They would buy us muzzleloader tags, rifle tags, just to kind of extend their own seasons. Now when I switched to archery hunting, my freshman year in college, between my senior year of high school and freshman year of college, I went to the store and bought a Primo's bugle and some calls and got pretty efficient with it fairly quickly. Went out, nobody bow hunted. So I was just going out calling elk, you know, without anything, and was very successful before season, during the archery season. And so it kind of sparked this interest that, I was going to pick a bow up and go elk hunt with my bow. It seemed too easy, too good to be true. Well, I didn't know at the time that archery was a whole different animal. You didn't just go sight it in, you know, 2 days before season, make sure you were hit, you know, make sure you were hitting 2 inches high at 100 yards and go out and do your thing. And so I did get a bow. I I thought I was good. I went to a few 3D shoots, and that first year in the early season, I missed four or five bowls at chip shots. Just, you know, nerves got to me. I wasn't, you know, I didn't have everything down. I wasn't, you know, calm and cool. Ended up killing a bull still later that year in my first year archery hunting, but I learned a lot of lessons. And then from then on, it really clicked on how much time and dedication it was going to take to not only call bulls in, but be, you know, successful and efficient every single year. And then from there on out, I've had fairly good success, but that first year, definitely taught me some lessons on, it wasn't going to be as easy as rifle hunting had been. And there was, you know, the archery dedication was needed.
Right. So how old were you then when you decided to start Phelps Game Calls, and what year was that?
So that was 2009. And I've always been kind of that obsessive compulsive guy, but hunting has always been the staple. Like, I've always been obsessed about hunting, everything about it. As much time as I can spend from July, you know, looking at, you know, bulls and bucks and velvet until the last, you know, December season's up. I always wanted to go with somebody, help somebody out, find them an animal, whatever. So I've always been obsessed. So 2009, after I was building high performance, ATV and motorcycle motors for racing and stuff, and that had kind of lapsed, and I found myself bored, you know, is that obsessive compulsive side.
Yeah.
ran out of stuff to do. I'm like, well, I love elk hunting. I love calling elk. I'm fairly good at it. Let's see, you know, there's a need. I thought there was a need for, you know, new products, more consistent products. And so it kind of just sparked that side. Well, you know, I grew up out in the woods. I knew how to use, you know, a wood lathe, you know, kind of how to do all that. But the whole call side, like, how do you get the sounds? And so that, you know, as the forums were kicking off, there's custom call building forums. I just started paying a lot of attention, finding out where you can get material sources from, where you can do, you know, where you can kind of put these parts together to develop your own calls. And then it kind of just molded from there. We started out with just a wood external call. You know, didn't necessarily do anything new or different, just marketed it fairly well. You know, used it in some of our videos, which kind of sparked as well. And then from there, it's kind of whirlwinded out of control. Now we have, you know, three or four different styles of diaphragms, you know, brand new Beagle tube. We're working on four or five new products now, but it has been a slow, you know, a slow building process. I always kind of look back at the analogy, you know, a house is first built on a foundation or it's going to fall over. And so we didn't, you know, there's all these dreams and ambitions when I was first starting that, you know, I want to grow this thing and make $20 million a year like Primo's, or, you know, or I just pulled that number out of the air, you know, just some big number. I want to make a killing on this. But at the same time, I didn't know if I would sell four or five. About year two, it kind of all switched. I kind of fell in love with the journey, you know, not so much the end. I don't even pay attention. I don't have an end goal anymore. You know, it might be bad business, but, you know, everybody's got these, well, you want to get here or get there. I fell in love with this journey of just creating new calls. You know, I've got a priority list of, well, you know, I want an external elk call next. I want a jackrabbit distress, and I want a cottontail distress. And so I've just kind of, you know, as money comes along and we have money available, I've just fell in love with this journey of developing the best calls I can and just kind of chasing my passion, which is.
So did you decide right off the bat, hey, I want to start a business first, then I started making calls? Or it sounds to me like you're obsessive compulsive disorder, right? I mean, you said, I want to try to make my own calls. And that then did that spark into a business opportunity, or was it vice versa?
Yeah. So I had ran a business before. I was kind of a little burnt out coming off of, you know, the rebound of that business, not really failing, just not panning out how I had envisioned it in my head. So it was more of a hobby. I didn't, you know, the first 6 months when I was building calls, I didn't have a business license. I didn't have any intention of selling calls really. It was just to tinker around and give my buddy some calls. Well, I started to give a few away just, you know, to see what people think and try to improve the product. And like monstermealies.com, huntingwashington.com, some of the forums out there. And then people started asking for them and wanting them, and I would build more. And so then about 6 months into it, I decided, well, you know, it's going to turn into a business, or if I'm going to accept any money, it has to be a business. So we went that route, and then things just kind of, like I said, it just turned into more of the journey. Being a diehard archery elk hunter, I know that diaphragms are your next step. So I started researching, well, you know, who sells the, you know, components to make diaphragms? Who do I got to go to get a press? Where do we get latex from? And started down that journey. And that was kind of my next big investment in 2011. I bought a press and started making my own diaphragm. So we ran on just the wood elk calls for about 2 years. And then about 2011, I decided that I needed to order my own diaphragm press and started that side of the business.
So, all right. So you're a decent caller. You start a business, you know. How did you decide, you know, and you started with elk, which from my understanding, elk have so many different vocalizations, more than, you know, than a whitetail, right? You think of a whitetail, you got a grunt, you got a snort wheeze, and there's probably some other things, and they blow when they're mad, right? Or when they're scared. Now, from my understanding and from reading on elk and all this, you know, all these other things, they have tens of different vocalization, you know, like 10, 15, I don't know how many, but just a lot. So how do you go and you perfect a sound like that to make it, I guess, mouthwatering for the animal that you're trying to kill?
So, you know, so by studying the forums, I learned, you know, the radius is on the, you know, without nerding out here completely, the radius is on the tone board, the thickness of the mylar reed that vibrates, just like on your white-tailed deer calls, you know, you have a piece of mylar reed that kind of overhangs the tone board, that vibrates, that gives us a sound. So you start to figure out that you can modify the tone board itself, which is, you know, when I'm developing my own calls, I'm using a file and, you know, a lathe and an end mill to develop that. And I can shave a I can either flatten the radius, I can steepen the radius, things like that. On the reed, I can either change thickness of mylar from 10,000ths to 14,000ths to 20,000ths. And then we can also change the shape. So you're basically changing the weight of that mylar reed to affect, you know, the tone of the vibration. And then we can change the barrel length, diameter, and then the wood we're using on the barrel to richen up the tone, kind of deaden it out. And so you can play with those three factors and kind of dial in that sound you want.
All right. So everything you just said was like 20,000 feet over my head, right? So So you build this product, right? And maybe you're using it around the shop, right? And it sounds good to you.
Yep.
How do you go out and then test it to see if it actually works and it actually works on the animal that you're trying to kill?
So that's exactly what we do. You know, so we would just take it out in the woods and use it. Especially in that first year when I didn't know it was going to be a business, I still had all of my commercial calls, you know, the stuff I could get from, you know, Cabela's and Bass Pro or whatnot, or the local pro shop. I still had those calls, but I went out with a purpose to try to use my calls solely. And then if they were just completely, you know, causing me failure, that I could switch back. And so we found out in that first year that these wood calls were extremely effective. And, you know, I was trying to sell them as well and get hunts on video, but we didn't need to use them just for that. We use them because how effective they were. And so like last year, I came out with a brand new amp diaphragm. I call it my amp series. We actually allowed about 50 or 60 testers last year to use them, give us feedback before we ever launched them to the public. Now, I was 99.5% confident that I could have released them to the public without being tested. But I wanted feedback. I wanted feedback on what ones were the best, what ones do include in the lineup and exclude, so that you don't start off with a bunch, you know, any bad reviews or anything. And so Not only did they test the effectiveness, the use, kind of the durability over a season, but they were able to try to make sure that that product came out to everybody else as good as possible. And so we always try to get next year's products in the hands of hunters the year before. Nobody really knows they have them besides, you know, them and me. But we do always try to get some field time on them and find out, hey, you know, this thing may sound perfect to our ears. Even when I test the call, I go down below my house. I have a bunch of timber below my house. I'll video myself on my video camera, you know, 100 yards away, but I'll be down in the trees calling. I want to hear what that call sounds like in that instance, what it sounds like in the sound, what my buddies think it sound like. And then, you know, really, we can all think it sounds as good as we want to, but if the elk don't, you know, agree with us, it doesn't do it any good. Okay. So we truly field test everything.
So you hand your call out to 50 people. Did any of that feedback that came back to you influence any tweaks or 2.0 versions that, you know, changes you need to make before the end release?
When we sent those out, we sent about 10 different styles and specifications out. From what everybody sent back to us, the feedback was actually surprisingly well, even across the board. We did take everybody's suggestions and narrowed it down to about five final production calls to release right off the bat. So it wasn't so much making tweaks to the call itself, but rather what latex type, thickness, and specification we were going to bring them out. So that was more of the feedback. You know, the durability had seemed to be good for most. We did make some changes on durability and some specs, but for the most part, it was more paring down what type of latex we wanted to use into what stretch.
Okay. So what are the most important things to making? And I'm going to say the word call as a general term, but if you want to break it down by diaphragm, by bugle, by reed call, what makes an elk call good?
So in my opinion, when I'm designing a call from the ground up, I always, no matter, you know, if I'm blowing the call and I'll call myself a professional, you know, I hate saying a good caller like me, but I can run almost any elk call really well. I want it to be as easy as possible for me, but I also want to be for that call to be as easy as possible for the brand new caller to pick up or the intermediate caller to pick up. So first of all, I always try to design it to be very easy to use regardless of who's using it. And so that's my number one priority. Number two, it needs to sound good. So easy to use, sound good and accurate. And then number three, I want it to be good over a spectrum. So now, as I already mentioned, you know, you got your professional caller on the right side, you got your brand new caller on the left side. I want that call to be desirable for the expert caller, and I want that call to be desirable for the beginner caller so that they can grow with that and not feel like they need to get something else. So it's kind of that one-stop shop on that call. And then with that, what we have to do on the backside is build durability and consistency into that call. In my opinion, consistency is the most important. When you have a guy that orders, call X today, and he orders call X in 2 months, I feel that that call should be the exact same call he takes out of the package and should be able to pick up right where that call was that he had from 2 months ago, where it seemed like there for a while there were some issues with consistency and quality across the board. And then durability. You know, elk calls by nature, it's tough to tell people you're only going to get 2 or 3 days out of a call. But that seems to kind of be maybe the status quo for a lot of people. So if I can even stretch it out to 5 or 6 days or 10 days and build that durability into the call, it's a huge selling point.
Okay. So I should have bought two. I don't even know. I think I bought mine from Cabela's, but online, but I bought one diaphragm call. Should I have bought two diaphragm calls because the durability of something like that is of diaphragm calls is on like a weekly basis?
It depends. If you know that's the call you like and you've bought before and are going to use, then you could buy two of it. I don't want to oversell to anybody right off the bat because there's no for sure way that that call is going to work for you. So maybe buy one, see if it is the right call, and then, you know, buy two or three potentially for season. And it depends on what type of hunt you're on. If you have the ability to run back to the bow shop on day three because your call broke out or blew out, then that's a different scenario. Whereas if I'm going on a backpack hunt for 10 days straight, I don't have the ability to run. I don't even want to walk back to the truck to get a different call. So it just depends on what type of hunt you're on. But besides diaphragms, most of your calls are reusable year to year. Even our wood calls, our bugle tubes for sure, pot turkey calls, box calls, all of those are reusable year to year. The consumables are really diaphragms. The latex just doesn't have a whole lot of UV resistance. Just over time, they eventually start to lose their stretch, sun crack and other issues. So if you have a call you really, really like, some guys can stick them in the refrigerator over a winter and, get some more life out of them. But there's no need to just, they're fairly cheap. You can pick them up and kind of have a fresh batch for the next year.
All right. So you started off with the elk calls, right?
Yep.
Then you expanded to elk diaphragms. You also sell turkey diaphragms now. So was that just a no-brainer step? Because when you look at them, they look almost exactly the same.
Yeah, everything is – the process is the same. The material is the same. The tape's the same. Everything is the same. It's just coming up with a spec. So excuse me. At the time that I started making elk calls, I was almost simultaneously making turkey calls on the diaphragm. At the same time, it's a natural progression. Why not add a few new SKUs to your lineup and, do some things that you wanted to do with turkey calls. If you're not completely happy with what you've been buying, I was able to build some of my tweaks right into my own calls.
Okay. Now, and go ahead.
I was going to say, and the price to entry is basically the price of material. You've already invested in the press. So it's right there. And, make them on the same exact machine.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, you also, so as a, everybody kind of knows you right off the bat for, making elk calls. How hard was it to, start marketing towards the turkey hunter as well? Was it kind of a seamless transition, or was it, did it take some time to get your name out there to say, hey, we make turkey calls too?
Yeah, the turkey calls are definitely, lagging from the elk calls. We don't put as much effort, as much time, as much money into marketing them. I really use the turkey calls to pick up all my existing customers, guys that I knew out west that are elk hunting, but they also turkey hunt out west. So that's really kind of my demographic. There are so many more turkey call manufacturers than elk call manufacturers. It's a little bit depressing when you look at getting in the marketing race and trying to compete there. So I had kind of made the strategy just to compete against the Western turkey hunter and try to market my calls to people out west. East of the Mississippi, there's probably – I'm just going to take a stab at it. There may be, 100 to 500 times as many turkey hunters east of the Mississippi as there are west.
Okay. Why is it important, and especially for diaphragms, I'm looking at online right now, right? And for your elk, you have tons of diaphragms, right? It looks like you have two different reed calls and one bugle. So from a diaphragm perspective, why do you offer so many? Why do you have so many different options for diaphragms?
So on the elk call side specifically, the diaphragms, and I hope no turkey hunters hate me for this. In my opinion, when you're trying to select your go-to call on an elk call side, there's so many variables on that. Not only that, but then the fit is important. So you can see for instance, on the elk call side, I've got an amp series, which has a modified plate over top of the latex. And then I've also got flat or conventional style diaphragms. that have multiple layers. Some of them are single layer. Some of them are double layer with cuts in the top reed. Some of them are triples with cuts in the top reed. You truly, excuse me, it's truly just trying to figure out what call works for the majority of the people. And then these calls, in my eyes, all truly do something different and excel in certain spots. So on the conventional side, I think we have 11 SKUs still. And then on the amp side, we only have 5 SKUs. The amp seems to be a little more universal. A lot of, you know, it's a lot easier. It's more of a one size fits all. So a guy with a narrow high palate can use them. A guy with a wide, you know, basically flat palate can still use those amp style diaphragms.
Okay.
Now on the flat side, we offer 3 different sizes. I've got a small frame, a medium frame, and a large frame. And that's because the fitment of that frame up inside your palate is of huge importance in order to be able to run that call.
Okay. So I'm looking at the names of these, right? So like the Pleading Hottie, the Signature Bull, the Signature Cow, Monster, Herd Wrecker, Elk Commander, all these things. When a guy walks into up into the mountains and he starts calling, and you mentioned each one of these kind of does something different, to an untrained ear like myself, it may sound the same. What are the differences here? What do those differences do?
So a lot of them are thicknesses of latex. Every color of latex actually has a slightly different sound, a slightly different property on how much water retention or spit retention at that point. They're all stretched different. So like the Signature Cow, it's going to be stretched not near as much as a Signature Bull. And the reason being, on a Signature Bull, I wanted that call to be able to go up and hit that high note for bugling. Where on the Signature Cow, I wanted it to be stretched a little bit more lax so you can get those really easy, deep estrus-type sounds out of the cow side. And so it's truly trying to come up with the best solution for that type of latex, or for all the latexes. You know, I've built the Signature Cow with every style, every thickness of latex, and in my opinion, that blue latex we use on it has that deep sound, and it works well.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now, like, for instance, the Beast – it uses a very thin piece of prophylactic with a very heavy backer reed. Now, when I locate off of a big Idaho ridge or a big Montana ridge down into a 3,000-foot hole, that call has a very high pitch. It carries better than all these other calls. So that's a call I would maybe use for locating versus some of the others.
Okay. So there's different scenarios where you would use different calls, whether you're far away, you're close, nothing's responding or everything's responding, or so there's just different scenarios for every type of call.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Or different calling styles. So like one guy may use the Monster for their locating. It has a little bit thicker reed, where I use the Beast, and so it truly is that different from person to person on the call that they need to use to get that same tone, where I may need a different call.
Okay. So as far as, from a company standpoint, how important is it to not only just sell a quality product, but educate your customers on how to properly use your product?
Extremely. And I would like to think that we do as good a job as anyone out there, whether it's, I've took advantage of texting, Facebook messaging. I have 10 to 20 customers a day sending me audio clips of themselves running a call. it's something that if I sell you the call, I would just assume see you be able to use my call than go try to pick up, another manufacturer's, because I do believe that, some of these calls are easiest to use. And so I need to do a better job educating, whether that's through videos, through hunts, through texting, just from being around it enough, I can listen to somebody calling and diagnose fairly quickly, probably what the issue is. And I've been able to help countless people through emails or text kind of fix their problem.
That's kind of funny. So people call you and say, all right, listen to this. What am I doing wrong?
Yeah. Or they record themselves and text it to me, and gives me a little bit, because answering the phone all day cuts into my efficiency. But yeah, anybody's more anybody's more than welcome to text or message me an audio file. And when I sit down at night, I'll go through them and try to provide some feedback.
All right. I tell you what, that's customer service on a next level.
We try.
So, you know, kind of elaborating on that a little bit, do you guys put out like instructional videos? Do you put out audio? Like, okay, this is how you're supposed to use it. This is what it should sound like. And then tips and tricks on how to achieve that?
We don't yet. It's on my very top of the list on things that me and one of my hunting partners were going to put together. It just hasn't come to fruition yet. We've been fairly overwhelmed with orders, and it's tough to get to that when you're constantly building calls.
Right. Amen.
So it's definitely something that's needed, and customer feedback. You know, if I had those videos available, I would spend a lot less time listening to people call on my phone. So
you need to hire someone just to listen to bugles.
Yeah. So it's something we have kind of a 10-part series laid out. We just haven't acted on it yet.
I gotcha. So from a growth standpoint, you guys have elk calls, you have turkey calls, you also have predator calls, and I'm looking on your website here. It looks like you have deer and waterfowl calls. So is this something that, I mean, you're going to try to brand every type of call for every type of animal that you possibly can, or are you going to stick to and focus on like the elk and the predator and the turkey?
So my comfort level, my expertise comes in what we're already producing, the turkey, the elk, and the predator. It wouldn't be right for me to come out with a bunch of deer and waterfowl calls and try to piggyback on my success that I've had with elk and predator and turkey, due to my own knowledge. And so I think, future, I look forward to teaming up with some waterfowl callers and some, guys that spend a lot of time in a deer blind or a tree stand that listen to deer. I'll still be kind of the creative brain behind the project, with the ability to design and create the product. But I'm definitely going to lean heavily on feedback from some of these, I would say, kind of those sector professionals, the guys that are out there deer hunting all the time, know more about deer calling than me, and for me to, understand that and rely heavily on them. And so I just want to be careful on the growth of the company, on the, making sure that if we are going to build something that it truly is good, unique, and is going to work.
Right. Now, new products, right? So when you find free time, you're not listening to voice messages or you're not actually making the product, and you start thinking about what comes next. What's that process look like? And, how do you know what product is going to be the next product for Phelps?
It comes a lot on customer feedback. At the sportsman shows this year, guys come up to you, hey, do you have an external bugle? Something where they don't have to run a diaphragm in their mouth, but it still allows them to bugle. You get that question enough times, it's on your radar, and then it goes from your radar to kind of the top priority. And then I also look at kind of the line we've got developed. We have external wood calls. We have a really solid diaphragm lineup. We have bugle tubes. Do we really need to put time in that, or should we expand, or should we reinvent the wheel or develop something new? And so when we have that list, and then we go down the list, and then so to get into a design, you kind of know what's going to work. Can you use some of your existing products in that new part? And then being a professional engineer, by nature, I've got some design background. I can take advantage of some processes that allow me to test prototypes very quickly. My brother's also an engineer who's a better 3D drafter than I am. And so I can design the part, he can draft the part, and we can have working prototypes, within a couple of days. From paper to working part, fairly quickly. We also, I still like to consider myself a little bit of an old school call maker. I have a bunch of raw material out in the garage. I can take a piece of plastic, you know, put a radius into a board off of a public jig and then just start to sand this part down, or go out to one of my lathes and you know, build a new barrel out of whatever material I want. And so it gives me kind of the flexibility to test these parts in real world before we ever try to invest a whole bunch of money into production of these parts.
Right.
Go ahead. So conceptually, I've got tons of shelved products out in the shop. You know, this is good. This is good. This is good. It's just every time you get ready to go to production, it seems like every time, whatever I think it should cost, I always have to add like two or three zeros to the end of what it's actually going to cost to get a single new product, to be able to sell.
Right. So then, you know, as your company, I mean, you mentioned that you're having fun on just this journey. And it's just kind of doing what you feel, you know, a lot of feeling and less on trying to make money and trying to, you know, hit that $10 million mark, like you said. It seems like it's more of a journey for you. So where do you see Phelps Game Calls in like the next 5 or 10 years? I mean, what's your goal?
As we mentioned earlier, I go day by day, you know. In those first 2 years, I had all kinds of goals. I wanted to be in Cabela's. I wanted to be in Sportsman's Warehouse. I wanted everybody on TV to use my, you know, kind of one of these high pie in the sky type goals. Right. And about 2 years, it clicked. Like, I don't really have a goal. We truly go day by day. I'm loving everything that we do. Something that makes me smile every day is the ability to help out, you know, friends and family that, you know, could use some extra income or could help with the business. You know, getting people involved that, you know, I can truly make a difference for. You know, it might sound cliche, it might sound over emotional, but it's one of those things that I've took a lot of a pleasure from the business is the ability to, you know, to help some people out and you know, give them jobs. And people that do a really, really good job for me building calls or helping out on, you know, certain components of building calls has been truly awesome. You know, so far we're not in any big box stores. I think the biggest outlet we're in is Shields. You know, and they're not even just a few stores order from us. Not even, you know, it's not a big order. And so we've truly grown this thing 100%, you know, come to us. I think we've got like 30 pro shops on board and we do a lot of our selling online. But we're just letting it grow kind of organically, I guess. Not searching for a whole bunch of business, do a good job marketing them on social media, try to be as informational as we can and let things kind of fall as they will.
Do you feel that a call, regardless of what the animal is you're trying to call in, do you feel a call is something that somebody can, if they're a first timer, they will buy it online? Or do you feel that a lot of your customers want to touch it, hold it, feel it, and use it before they end up making the purchase?
So that's another thing I found, or, you know, I guess I would have known it the whole time. With elk calls, it's something you can't go like a First Light jacket or a Sitka jacket and Cabela's. You can go try it on. You can zip the zipper up and down. You can put the hood on. You can do all these things. An elk call, you can't do that with, no matter what. I mean, no matter if it's a bugle tube, no matter if it's, unless your buddy's got one and he's willing to let you put it in his, you know, a diaphragm in his mouth or blow on his external. So we're kind of fortunate in that aspect. I still am an advocate for people going to all of the shops that support us and, you know, spending your money local. But people that aren't close enough to shops or shops that don't currently carry us yet, you know, ordering online, there's no real risk because it's the same risk you'd have of buying it in a store.
Gotcha.
You know.
So where does your 2000, you know, kind of going back to hunting now, where does your 2017 hunting season go? Are you going to different states? Are you going to stick to Washington and New Mexico, or what do you got planned for this upcoming year?
So Washington, it all depends on the draws. If I don't draw an Eastern Washington tag, I probably won't elk hunt in Washington. Deer hunting will be dependent on what I draw in other states. I do have a deer hunt and the archery elk hunt planned for Montana. I'll most likely archery elk hunt Idaho as well. And then it really just depends on the draw. So far I've got one deer hunt and two elk hunts planned.
Nice. Sounds like you're going to be fairly busy.
Yeah. Both out of state. You know, Washington, we do have some great opportunity, and I cut my teeth right here in my backyard, and it taught me a ton. It's just now I'm to a point where I just assume not be stuck in a brush pile and soaking wet all day. And I'd rather go hunt some more open country east and have a chance at some, you know, bigger, higher quality animals.
Gotcha. Well, first off, I want to say thank you very much for taking time out of your day to come on the podcast and chat with me today. And second, good luck this upcoming season.
Thanks. You too. And it was a pleasure, and glad we could finally meet up.
There you have it. First off, huge shout out to Jason for coming on the podcast and talking Phelps Game Calls with us. He has decided that he is going to give away one bugle tube and 3-amp diaphragms for this podcast. And here's how you win. The first thing you need to do is go to Phelps Game Calls. Make sure you like the page. Make sure you comment 9 fingers sent me. That's the first thing you do. The second thing you need to do is go to the 9 Finger Chronicles Facebook page, share the post that mentions this podcast, and though by doing those 3 things, you will be able to be entered into this giveaway for one bugle tube and 3-amp diaphragms from Phelps Game Calls. Looking forward to seeing who wins that. I'll let it ride out for about a week, so probably next week I'll pick a winner, and I will pull a name at random, and then I will go ahead and let you know via email or Facebook or whatever. So there's that. So thanks to Jason for coming on the podcast. Thanks, Jason, for the giveaway. Huge shout out to each and every one of you for taking time to download and listen. Huge shout out to the sponsors: Ozonix, Ripcord, Exodus, Deer Lab, Lone Wolf, Wasp Archery, Gearhead, and I think that's it. If you guys are going to be out in a tree stand, wear your damn safety harness. There's that. But again, please go sign up for the National Deer Alliance. If you haven't already, I'm going to beat this dead horse until it's nothing but a mushy pile of horsehair and blood and guts, because I feel it is that important. Please go sign up for the National Deer Alliance, get their newsletter, and become active and become educated on what's going on out there. So there's that. I think that's it. I've mentioned everything. Have an outstanding week, and like I always say, man, wear your damn safety harness. Thank you.